So, welcome everybody. My name is Alexander Micklethwaite, music director of the Oklahoma City Philharmonic. And I'm sitting with our third trumpeter, Michael Anderson. It's a real honor and pleasure to have you. He's an absolutely fascinating character. Well, you wonder why am I sitting here with a good cup of coffee, and we'll discuss this in a second if this is a good cup of coffee or not. Why do I sit here with our third trumpeter? And the reason is, as you probably know, because of the pandemic, we moved our concerts in January and February all the way to spring. We have a little bit of an opening here, and we want to keep the communication going with you guys, with our audience. So we thought, why not dig deeper into the passions, into the obsessions of our musicians that are not all only musically oriented. There are many other interests that are there, very fascinating and exciting. Okay, now I picked as the first, again, Michael. For you who don't know Michael, he is, and I have to read a little bit, not only plays for the Philharmonic, one of the main jobs, Michael is the professor of trumpet at the Wanda Bass School of Music here at the Oklahoma City University, and that's actually where we are right now. Thank you, OCU. He's a member of the International Trumpet Guild Board of Directors and ITG Journal Editorial Committee. What is ITG?
International Trumpet,
Trumpet. Got it. Executive Director of the Guild's website and Chairman of the International Trumpet Guild Technology Committee, etc. And then he is an active freelance trumpeter all over the state. Well, you get the gist. He is extremely talented on his instrument. But today we are talking a little bit about music and then about lots of other things. And I guess the first place I want to start is with what I'm holding in my hand. Give me 1 second. All right, Michael, it's your turn.
Okay.
Actually, I really don't like it. Well, it is coffee. It's real coffee. I have a little bit cream in, half and half. Michael, how's yours?
It's black.
It's black.
It's coffee.
It's what one says is coffee.
Yes.
Okay. So why I'm starting with this specific drink here? Well, we have it, of course, as our little coffee talk. And Michael Anderson is one of the coffee connoisseurs, let's say, of Oklahoma City, maybe of Oklahoma State. He is, well, let's dig into it. Michael, welcome, first of all, again.
Thank you.
And yeah, so let's chat about that part of your life. Why is it, what is it about the coffee that it's not really to your taste or to one's taste? Let's dig in.
Well, it's a hobby. Coffee is a hobby for a lot of people. It's extremely popular all over the world, not just in our country. Good coffee, really good coffee, can be found in just about any decent-sized city. So it's much more accessible than it used to be. I started my coffee journey, you know, into specialty coffee, what we now call third-wave coffee, decades ago. You know, my wife and I really love coffee. She's Lutheran, so it's kind of a requirement, right?
Okay.
But we coffee every day, of course, like a lot of people at home, and we wanted to get a little deeper into it, and we figured out a way to actually roast our own coffee so that the coffee was fresh. We lived in a small town at the time, and there were not nearly as many coffee shops, specialty shops, as there are now. I'm talking about in the 80s. And so we figured out, just by doing some research, that you could get the beans in green form, pre-roasted, and roast them yourself and have them on hand fresh, because what you get in the supermarket could often be months old. And once coffee is roasted, it goes stale very quickly. So the big advantage to us roasting our own is freshness. And it makes a huge difference in the final taste. Probably the reason why you don't like this coffee is that it's not the freshest. and the quality of the bean and where the bean comes from and how it was raised and how it was went from cherry form to bean form. All that makes a difference in the final flavor. And the way you roast it is probably the most important aspect of that. So we did it out of necessity, just for a wish to have, you know, better coffee, more fresh coffee at home. And I've, you know, I've in the last, you know, probably 10 years, I've gotten a little bit deeper into trying different kinds of beans and different ways of roasting and whatnot.
And so in a nutshell, for the layman like me, right? I mean, I can get the coffee at Dunkin' Donuts, at Starbucks, you name it. And then it seems that maybe since, what, 15 years, 20 years, there are those individual roasteries, like coming all over. It's wonderful also, yes, you know, to have people that really dig into the art of coffee making, not the big chains, but also the smaller ones.
Specialty.
Specialty.
Yeah.
So from your perspective, if one wants a good cup of coffee, like just from that perspective, like what do you suggest? What's the difference? I mean, we had this conversation, you know, like the Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, Elemental, like the special, what's the difference?
Well, there's a trend now in the specialty coffee places. You know, Elemental is a good example, Class and Coffee, Clarity, there are a ton of them all over the place. But the trend, kind of like what's happened in beer with IPA getting more and more sour and hoppy, they call it, IPA, more and more and more hops. I don't happen to really like that flavor profile. In coffee, what's happened is that roasters are going lighter and lighter and lighter with their roasts in order to pull out what they call origin flavors. So for me, when I roast dark, and I prefer darker roasted coffee, even though I've experimented with light coffee, I prefer darker roasted coffee just because it has that roasty coffee flavor. Whereas what I call the hipster coffee places, the third wave, the specialty coffee places, most of them, not all of them, but most of them go toward the light end. You can walk in and say, can I get a dark roasted coffee? And they will say, no, we do not have that here. And I suppose some might compare that to walking into a fancy hipster bar and asking for a Coors Light. I don't know. But to me, really good, fresh, dark roasted coffee is what I prefer. And it's actually hard to find in the specialty shops. I think you can get that sometimes at Coffee Slingers. If you get like a French press there, you can get it to be really dark. But otherwise, it's kind of hard to come by. You can definitely get it at Starbucks because their coffee is all dark for the most part. Even their blonde roasts are darker than most of the specialty coffee places.
And at the end, of course, it's all personal taste. You know, there's no judgment. It's what everyone
absolutely
likes.
So
for maybe some of our listeners that are coffee aficionados, what's your setup? I mean, what's your the brand that you use for your roaster or your grinder? You know, how far up can you go?
There's a lot of gear. And my COVID project was installing an espresso coffee bar in my home. And I went down the rabbit hole pretty far. I spent a lot of money doing it. But I make really good espresso drinks at home now, which I really couldn't do that before. So it involved just a lot of research. That's the hobby aspect of it. You know, when I take on a hobby, I really want to learn as much as I possibly can about it. But I've been roasting long before I kind of got deep into it. I've been doing basic roasting beans that in a way that I like. I upgraded my roaster in the last couple of years for a larger capacity, but I actually roast. I have a dedicated gas grill outside that is dedicated to roasting coffee. There are many ways to do it at home. The drum that I have that I put the coffee beans in is on a rotisserie, so it moves with the heat. You got to get the heat just right, the duration just right, the weight's just right. But that's how I do it. I do it at home. When we first started, we did it on an air popping popcorn machine, and my wife wouldn't let me do it inside because it creates a lot of smoke. So we'd do it out in the garage. We lived in Nebraska at the time. It would be 5 below and I'd be out in the garage roasting a cup of coffee beans. Now I can do 3 or 4 pounds at a time. So I have a little bit more control than I did over the popcorn popper, but all of it is just, it's the same. You just, it just depends on how much variation you want, what you do. We found a bean and a roast profile that we liked and we just pretty much stuck to it. And our daily morning coffee is still just drip coffee. And I use Ethiopian coffee for that. I think that's what I've been giving you also. Mm-hmm. I roast other coffees for the espresso machine and I roast it totally differently for making espresso.
So when we started talking about coffee a couple of months ago, I told you that I am finally grinding my own beans and I was so excited, you know? And he asked me, so what grinder do you have? And I was like, what do you mean? The different grinders. So I had the one with the blade, you know, the blade grinder. I was like, yeah, that's what I have. And he's like, well, wait a minute. There's a better one. So what grinders did you suggest? What should one get?
Yeah, well, let me preface that by saying that when you're getting to this level of coffee, the quality of the grind is as important, if not more important, than the machine or the way you're brewing it, or even the coffee itself. The quality of the grind really affects the extraction of the coffee when you brew it, no matter how you brew it. So they say in espresso setups, you should spend more on your grinder than you do your espresso machine. I haven't done that. My espresso machine costs a lot more than my grinder. I have several grinders because I don't want to constantly be changing the setting. So we have a grinder for our drip, and I have a grinder for pour overs, and I have a grinder for espresso. That's a little bit of overkill, but that's where I am.
And the burr grinder?
Yeah, burr grinder. So there are conical burrs and flat burrs. There's argument as to which one is better. They're both very good, much better than a blade grinder, because the blade grinder, the grind is inconsistent, and it also burns the beans in the process.
Right.
So I would say a good burr grinder is the best way to go for a variety of ways of making coffee.
And then the last step before we move to something else is really the way I now learned to pour the boiling water, the very hot water. You have this cone-shaped
brewer.
So, and again, back to you, what is the system? There's a video you showed me that was quite detail-oriented, how many seconds of which part one is, you know, pouring the water on.
You can go way deep down in the rabbit hole. And I've actually done some taste testing where I followed the directions explicitly, every little detail, and then side by side, I'll just pour it in willy-nilly. And there actually is a difference in taste. They both taste great, but, you know, you can get really specific with it. And the video I shared with you is one of those. Depending on the brewer, there are videos for almost every kind of pour-over brewer there is. The concepts are the same, but the way the brewer is constructed can change what's called pass-through. So when you're pouring over, some of the water just goes down the sides without going through the beans. And the type of brewer you use and the style that you pour the water in can affect how much extraction you get out of the coffee. It's all about the extraction. The grind affects the extraction. The technique with the pour over and the actual brewer itself, all of them have an effect on how much extraction or how little extraction there is.
And I have great cups of coffee every morning right now because I learned something.
I'm glad you like it.
Oh yeah. Awesome. Okay, so this is just one chapter in Michael's life. Another one is I'm a Facebook friend of his and he posts lots of stuff, and one is amazing photos, wildlife photos. But not only wildlife, he goes from birds, like all sorts, and then insects. That was quite a huge departure last year or something, mm-hmm. Spiders. It's amazing, first of all.
Thank you.
How long do you do that? How did you get to that?
That's a really good question. I had no interest in photography, a little bit in high school, but in my work with the International Tropic Guild, we cover the conferences live, and we've been doing this since 2008. And we had a photographer that would take pictures, and then I would edit them and put them into websites so people who weren't at the conference could follow along with pictures. And we didn't really do much video, but reporters would write reviews on the events, and we would just basically report it as it was happening. Well, one year, our great photographer was ill and couldn't do the conference. And I said, I can try it. And so that's how I got into photography, just simply to fill this one little role at ITG. And you talk about a rabbit hole. That's a big rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2011. So I've only been doing photography since then. And one thing leads to another, I really enjoyed shooting the concerts as a musician. Shooting concerts, covering concerts is the most rewarding thing I do because, you know, unlike most photographers, I know the music intimately. I know what to listen for and what to look for and where to focus. And it was an easy transition for me to specialize in concert photography. That led me to an interest in shooting headshots because I like to shoot people. So, and then that led to shooting wildlife, which is a whole different scenario than shooting people. Mm-hmm. But for me, they pretty much have to have eyes for me to be interested. Landscapes don't interest me. Mm-hmm. Architecture photography doesn't interest me, even though I know a little bit about it. For me, it's shooting wildlife and people that I find the most rewarding.
So, but back to this first, I guess, conference, mm-hmm. I guess it's a little bit like that first conference, like saying, well, there was no coffee and I just quickly did a coffee run, right? And provide everybody with coffee.
Right.
And that led down to this, that I'm now a specialist. Same here, probably.
Yes.
The beginning, I mean, to take a photo quickly with my camera, everybody can do that. But what are the steps now in that visual world to create from two sides, the equipment, mm-hmm. the potential of creating high-end, what do you look for in equipment, but then also from the aesthetic to come to a different place?
Yeah, I had no training. Everything I learned about photography, I learned online and from a couple of individuals here in town that I know well now as mentors. That got me started. The gear, as with coffee, the deeper you go into it, the more gear you accumulate. And that's very true in photography. And it's expensive gear, you know. So you want to be able to use it and get the most out of it and make sure that what you're purchasing is really going to serve the end means. Learning about composition. I didn't go to art school. I have a good eye for it, but some of it is training. Some of it is, you know, reading texts and watching YouTube videos of real experts explain what makes a good composition. So a lot of it is trial and error. I can't stand looking at my pictures from 2011 or 2012. Mm-hmm. I've come a long way since then, and it's just a logical progression. Same thing with, you know, being a student of music. You know, you get better and better the more you practice it, and the more you listen to other people's work, the more you look at other photographers' work. You emulate that, then eventually you develop a style of your own. It's the same thing in music. There's a direct connection there. And that's true in sports and all sorts of personal endeavors.
The pictures that I love the most are the ones, I mean, I'm speaking now more wildlife. Uh-huh. I mean, I saw a whole bunch of like headshots. Mm-hmm. Also some amazing from how you capture in a way the character, right? Mm-hmm. From the wildlife. And this goes to a question regarding composition of the actual picture and now trying to connect it with music, composition of a piece of music. If you take anything out of that world. So back to my favorite pictures are the ones, let's suppose you have an owl or a great hairy, I don't know the names of like those birds like in flight that have a, let's say, brownish feathers, mm-hmm. and then the background is also brownish, and it kind of is this whole thing. It's like a painting. Mm-hmm. It's not random, right? It's like extremely beautiful, and then with the front in focus, the background, I guess, less focused.
Blurred, yeah.
But where the colors complement each other, and it's it seems very high end. Same then with the coffee, where everything comes together in a harmonious whole. So to music, is there something that you took from music, you know, that you like a composition where you felt this is, you bring this into that sensibility, visual sensibility or taste sensibility?
Sort of. I'm not a composer. I've never had any interest in that. Mm-hmm. And I've always felt as a musician that I was more of a craftsman than an artist. And I could argue that with you for an hour. People argue with me over this. Most of us that are in orchestral careers are craftsmen, craftspeople, I should say, not artists. I find that there's more creativity in art in my teaching than necessarily in my performing. So relating that to photography, it's nuts and bolts. It's learning the craft, how to operate the equipment. Some of it is luck, being in the right place at the right time. And a lot of it is after you've shot the photo, creating a frame with good composition, basic composition that I could teach you in 10 minutes, and manipulating the color slightly, but without making it look unnatural. That's where the art comes in, the creativity comes in after the fact, after you've actually shot the picture. So when you see that bird, that perfect pose with the wing in the perfect place and the feathers super sharp, there may be 200 other photos of that bird, and I have to choose which one is the best or which of the three are the best. So that's part of the artistic, creative aspect of it. The actual shooting of it is, you know, with a bird in flight, you're shooting very quickly, trying to follow the bird and just keep it in the viewfinder, which is hard to do. That's skill. That's craft. And then choosing the right shot and framing it. And you could relate that very directly to composition, mm-hmm. right? You have a style of composition that you want. But how you arrange the notes and how you organize the phrases is the creative aspect of it. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, yes, makes sense. Practically, let's go one step further. Regarding, I guess, the craft, one big part is to find the, let's say in wildlife, to find the territory, right? I mean, mm-hmm. maybe it's in your backyard, but several of those shots seem more that you had to drive a little further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you do that part? Can you give us some secret spots that you visit?
I won't do that, but a lot of it is trial and error. You know, the vast majority of what you see me post, I've shot in this region within mm-hmm. 15, 20 minutes of Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
A lot of it in my backyard. I am fortunate to have a little bit of a sanctuary in my backyard where there's a greenbelt area with lots of big old trees, and that brings a lot of wildlife in. Just this morning, there were two red-shouldered hawks soaring above my house today in Oklahoma City. You have to be present. You have to be looking. I'm mm-hmm. constantly looking. Mm-hmm. The only time I'm not looking is when I'm working. You know, otherwise, if I'm driving anywhere, I'm looking. There's almost always a camera on the seat next to me. So you got to be there. That's 9/10 of it, to be there. Mm-hmm. And then when it happens, which isn't every time, you got to be ready to capture it. Now, I have traveled. There's a place in north central Oklahoma I love to go called the Drummond Wildlife Refuge. Anybody can go there, Drummond. It's in the middle of nowhere in north central Oklahoma. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of owls and hawks there in the spring and summertime. There are shorebirds that are there because it floods. So that's a favorite spot close. I don't go there very often, but down around Lawton is the Wichita Mountain area. That's a wildlife place, big time. And there are a couple of other places in the state that are drivable. But most of my, I don't have time to go on long trips usually. Mm-hmm. So most of my shooting is in this area.
And I guess last photography question is actually about the equipment. When I was a teenager, I was slightly into it, and I had a, how do you call them in English? Spiegelreflex, the camera with a click, click. With a mirror.
Mirror, yeah. DSLR or an SLR.
I mean, those
single reflex lens. Is what it's
right,
called.
But then you had the lenses, right? And I had several zoom lenses that I bought and Tamron and stuff.
Yes.
So in order to get your shots that are seem to be, one of those. How big is your lens? What like zoom lens do you have?
For wildlife, I use a 500 millimeter Nikon lens. They came out with a special one that's not so heavy and it's lightweight and it's short and I can use it handheld. I don't need a tripod. A lot of the really good wildlife photographers have these huge lenses that of course zoom in more, but they have to put them on a tripod and what's called a gimbal, and they're stuck in one place. I'm constantly moving in my car. Most of the shots that I do, not all, but most of them are I'm sitting in my car when I shoot them because birds are used to cars. You know, so you'll see a bird, and if you're lucky, it won't fly off immediately when you stop the car. If you were to drive right by them, they wouldn't move because they're used to cars going by. So that's what I do, and I just do a lot of it in the winter, particularly because there are no leaves. You see a lot more of the birds in the winter, and the raptors migrate down to this area. We have a lot of birds that come through Oklahoma that don't live in Oklahoma year-round. So every part of the year, I take a different approach to shooting and I'll go to different locations because the birds change. In the winter, it's raptors mostly.
Cool.
And I'm a Nikon guy. I shoot all Nikon. I have several cameras. I have a camera that specializes in the and lens in the wildlife area. What I use for headshots and concerts and the other events, the other kind of shooting, it's totally different equipment. So it's specialized.
So let's, like for the next 5 minutes, I guess, last 5 minutes, let's tilt back to the trumpet or to sound, let's say. Who was your most influential teacher?
Well, the most influential teacher wasn't actually my teacher. I grew up in central Illinois, about 2 hours south of Chicago. So as a young man, early in the journey, I went to hear the Chicago Symphony live many, many times. It was a common occurrence for me. So to me, the trumpet, the orchestral trumpet, was Bud Herseth, the longtime 50-year principal of the Chicago Symphony who set the standard for so many of us. That's the sound that was planted in my head as a young man that I still hear today. I can bring that sound up anytime I want. It's there. It's permanently installed. So as far as sound is concerned, that's my model. That's who taught me, even though he didn't teach me. And I pursued that. I got lucky where I grew up and, you know, my teacher said, go hear the Chicago Symphony. So I did. I also studied at the time over about an 8-year period on and off with Arnold Jacobs, who is the famed principal tubist of the Chicago Symphony and known very well as a brass pedagogue. And I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time with him. And so his concepts of teaching and his concepts of playing are ingrained in me as well. For graduate work, I moved to Lincoln, Nebraska and went to the University of Nebraska. And I studied with Dennis Schneider there, who all of his teaching and his philosophy of playing matched mine and my previous experiences really well. So it culminated in his teaching. I learned the most from him by sitting next to him in the Lincoln Symphony for 23 years. That's where I really learned a lot from him, just by listening to him play and him modeling how you behave in an orchestra and
so
whatnot.
I guess it was about coffee, and that for many people, just a coffee cup is just coffee. For others, you can really taste the whole palette. Visual, same thing. You know, one can dig in.
Yeah.
Now, for sound, for many of our listeners, it might be, well, is this a trumpet or is this a tuba? It can be very generic. You know, it's like, oh, that's, I think it's a trumpet. But here, again, one can go down the rabbit hole. How can you just explain, like in a minute, I guess, the sound concept? What does this mean, the sound? What do you hear? How deep can one hear that?
Well, the problem with putting sound into words is that we don't have the vocabulary, right? We have to borrow it from our other senses. So we have loud and we have soft, right? And we have fast and we have slow. But in terms of sound, there aren't any other words. So we borrow from the visual senses. This is a bright sound. This is a dark sound. right? This is a color. We talk about colors in our sound. That has nothing to do with the aural. We have to translate these things. So it's a very ambiguous subject. Mm-hmm. You develop your sense of sound first by modeling the people that you listen to. It's the same thing with speech, right? So as a trumpet player, I told you who my model was, and I, you know, in this style, that's who I follow, and that's the sound I heard in my head, until you start to develop subtle differences because of your own personal preference, right? It used to be you could tell who was playing principal trumpet in any of the major orchestras because their sounds were so distinctive. Anymore, with some exceptions, it's pretty generic, and it's almost difficult even for a professional player to recognize who's playing at any time. In the old days, same with string sections, right? You had the Philly strings and the Chicago strings and the New York strings, you could tell which were which, but not anymore, really. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is a rabbit hole, but it's not as cut and dried as the visual is. It's, as I said, very, very ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And so when you're training students to develop their sound, it's a slow process. And you do a lot of modeling, and they have to do a lot of listening. Listening is the absolute key to developing a really good sound on any instrument, but mm-hmm. particularly on the trumpet.
All right, last question. What are you reading books?
I read all the time.
What's on your night table?
I read in the car.
In the car you're reading? You're listening?
Audible.
Okay, what's your listening? I read about
40 books a year on Audible. Because it's downtime, right? I feel that downtime. Mm-hmm. I have a commute and I drive around a lot looking for birds and I listen to books while I do it. Right now I'm reading Tanya French. She has a series of murder mysteries. I really like her style. She's Irish. And so the readers are Irish and you got that Irish brogue and vocabulary that's just, to me, very romantic. But I read all sorts of things. The best thing I've read recently was Steven Van Zandt mm-hmm. from The Sopranos, actor from The mm-hmm. Sopranos, but a mm-hmm. guitarist, rock and roll guitarist. He's in the E Street Band with Bruce Springsteen. He just released a memoir that is phenomenal. Mm. If you're into rock history at all, I used to teach rock history, but if you're into, you know, that popular culture, it's just full of gems. It's a long book, and I enjoyed every minute of it. I don't often read nonfiction. It's very rare for me to do so. Mm-hmm. But my wife read this book, and she said I would love it. And, of course, he narrates it, mm-hmm. and he's quite a character. So that's the thing that sticks out to me in recent times that I really enjoyed was his memoir. It's called Unforgiven. Oh, I can't remember now.
Steven Van Zandt.
Steven Van Zandt. Stevie.
The Sopranos.
Yeah, little Stevie.
That's awesome. All right. Thank you so much.
This was
Michael Anderson, our third trumpeter from the Oklahoma City Philharmonic. And if you come to a concert next time and you see him, you can, of course, hear him, but then envision all those additional information, which might enrich your experience. All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Pleasure. It's my pleasure. I enjoyed our talk.
Yeah, me too. Bye-bye.